Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
This is Barron's Live. Each week, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our weekly webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today for a conversation with Michael Cugino, President and Portfolio Manager of the Permanent Portfolio of Funds. Barron's Deputy Editor Ben Levison joins today's call as well. Michael and Ben, I am delighted to have you both on Barron's Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you, Lauren. Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Fantastic. So, Michael, I have to tell you, I was recently at a dinner party with friends, and the conversation got around to investing, as it often does, I'm sure, when you go out as well. And the host mentioned that his favorite holding, maybe his only holding, is the permanent portfolio. And I have to tell you, my ears perked up. It reminded me it was time to reconnect with you, and I'm glad I did. So your fund is trademarked as a fund for all seasons, and it's certainly a fund for seasons when the broader market does poorly, as in 2022. And because it's such a strange beast with allocations across many asset classes, I thought I would let you explain it in your own words. What is the rationale behind the permanent portfolio, and where are you investing these days?
Well, it's an apt description to call it a fund for all seasons. It's an all-weather fund. It's an absolute return fund. I mean, all of those monikers would probably work. We've been around since 1982. It was designed during the economic times of that period where nothing was really working. And regardless of what investors did, they lost money. Even inflation was eroding purchasing power. So equities were down. You had double-digit short-term interest rates. You had gold up and down quite a bit, the Hunt brothers and silver, windfall profits. I mean, you name it, that late 70s, early 80s period. And so it was an antidote to that time of what's an investor to do to sort of grow wealth and maintain wealth. And the idea was that rather than try to predict markets, whether it's central banks or markets themselves or interest rates or, you know, who knows what industry sectors, the idea would be to provide a broad, comprehensive diversification among a bunch of different asset classes. And in that way, the investor didn't necessarily have to make predictions, but they would be exposed in many different areas. And that would provide multiple positive outcomes and maybe present or prevent downside risk and maybe produce a less volatile return. And the idea was also that most investors have a portfolio of stocks and bonds and maybe their personal residence as most of their wealth, maybe a second home. This fund went further, providing exposure to different asset classes that investors may not think about as being relevant, but were very important to economic activity and long-term growth. Commodities, precious metals, non-US exposure in stocks and bonds, real estate, for example, and potentially currencies and other countries' sovereign debt. So that was the idea behind it. We've been running it roughly in that same fashion with a broad asset mix since that time. It's been 42 years now. And it continues to do its job of preserving and growing capital in excess of inflation over the long term.
So you've got things broken down into various sleeves. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know you have about a 20% holding in gold, for instance. What else is in there?
Yeah, we have six broad asset categories, and we have a target weighting to each. 20% gold, as you mentioned, 5% silver, two equity sleeves, what we would call a hard asset equity sleeve, which would be 15%, and it would be raw materials, commodities, hard assets, those sorts of, you know, harder asset types of things. Then we have a traditional growth sleeve of another 15%. So it's 30% equity allocation. We have the remainder is in fixed income. 35% of that is in what we call dollar assets, which is investment grade debt, U.S. Treasuries, agencies, other sovereign debt, high quality debt. varying maturity and duration. We have flexibility to manage durations, but the common theme is that we want all the debt to be investment grade. And included in that is an allocation to Swiss government bonds and Swiss currency. So if my math is right, that does add up to 100% allocation. It is not an index fund. The target weightings are guideposts, and we generally are near them, but not directly on them. We use them as a measuring stick and as a, like I said, a guidepost to keep our asset allocation, not necessarily as an index fund.
So gold has been a tremendous winner this year. You recently told me you had a 22% position, which is a little bit higher than your target position of 20%. What's behind the runaway rally, and how much longer do you think it's going to last?
Yeah, that's accurate. We are slightly over our target percentage, and that's an example of, you know, being near the target but not right on it. We also have a rebalancing mechanism where if we go too far over or too far under our target weighting, we're required to rebalance the portfolio. So in that way, it makes it a balanced product at all times. Our gold weighting, I think, reflects where we see the economy right now with respect to gold and other precious metals. I think the biggest driver right now is the fact that the Fed is perceived as being done and likely cutting rates at some level over the rest of 2024 and beyond. That's a big discussion we can have as to whether it's appropriate and at what levels, but that generally is the market conventional wisdom right now. In addition, you have other factors such as very strong central bank buying around the world. You have a pretty good holiday season going on in India right now. You have the concerns over alternative currencies and alternative methods of payment for global commerce other than the US dollar. Which has been a topic that's been out there a little bit more lately than maybe, previous. And you have the general situation where when interest rates are perceived to be declining, there's a knee-jerk reaction that goes on with gold typically. Interest, it's kind of a caveman mentality. Interest rates up, gold bad, and there's an immediate sell-off. We didn't necessarily see that this time because I think we did see it in 2013 big time. During the taper tantrum, but we didn't see it lately. And I think the reasons are that there's some underlying unease with global economic growth and maybe the U.S. economy. I think the potential recession, if we get one, has been one of the most talked about recessions to come on the landscape in a long time. And we still are no closer to understanding whether we're going to have one or not, but we're all talking about it.
That's a fair point. We've been talking about it for 2 years already.
Talking about it, and maybe the data is slowly getting us there, but there's enough other data that says maybe not. So it's the most telegraphed recession or non-recession I can remember in my lifetime. And so gold, I think those factors are creating an unease among investors. So it didn't sell off as much as it typically does. And in fact, if you look back to when the Fed was raising aggressively the last couple of years, gold traditionally would have fallen off a cliff in that environment because the real return would not be keeping up with the rise in interest rates. And that didn't happen. Gold broke even that year, and it's been consolidating and trending up ever since. And so the belief is, or the understanding is, that as yields come down, as interest rates decline, the real return on that money gets smaller or goes negative. And that's a perceived bullish factor for gold.
So how long do you think this rally is going to go on, though? I guess it depends how you think the macro is going to play out.
I think it does. And also, gold has traditionally not been a linear move. It moves in lumps one way or the other. And investors have to get used to that. And so we've seen a big bump in the last week or so. That's totally in line with what it does in the short term. I think investors need to look at gold in a longer term fashion, unless you're a trader. And basically, you determine how you feel about your overall economic picture, your investment picture. You decide how much gold you want, whether it's insurance, alternative currency, hedging, et cetera, et cetera. And you figure out what that percentage is, and then you look for a reasonable price to you as to when to get in, and then not necessarily trade it, but just ride it, maybe adding or subtracting incrementally along the way, depending on how you feel about things, but maintaining a broad allocation. That's how we would probably say to invest it, and that's how we generally invest it in our portfolio. There can be lags between when a perceived economic activity happens and its impact on gold and when it actually impacts gold. One of the biggest ones is inflation. I think a lot of investors expect that if there's some sort of an announcement that inflation goes up in a given month's statistics, well, all of a sudden gold is going to run up because of that. Doesn't always work that way. It can be based on perceived inflation. It could be, based on all kinds of other softer factors, intangibles. But over time, it generally does perform in that direction. So if you look at gold over the longer term, it generally does behave consistent with rises in either perceived or actual real inflation, decline of purchasing power, geopolitical uncertainties, creation of money, et cetera, et cetera. But in the short term, it could do almost anything.
All right, let's talk about the Swiss franc assets that you own. Their bonds and other assets. Why the Swiss franc?
We wanted to have some exposure to a non-US currency. Most of our investors are US-based, and we wanted to have a dedicated exposure to a non-dollar currency. And, with our bent towards harder assets and that sort of thing in our portfolio, which there's no question we have, we view the Swiss franc and the behavior of the Swiss National Bank as an entity that would protect the value of that currency over time and provide almost a harder asset monetary offset or diversifier in the portfolio. And I think those beliefs have been borne out over time, by the way.
And let me ask you, I guess the yen is on the flip side of that. But with the Bank of Japan sort of pivoting to maybe a little tighter monetary policy, I would have expected the yen to go higher, but it really hasn't gained against the dollar. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about why it isn't going up.
I don't, and it's something to watch because it is unusual. And I think it's the move that we've seen is somewhat early days, or maybe we can't figure out why it's just like you can't. So it's something we're watching. We don't do much in terms of dollar yen trade specifically, but in terms of the broader overall, mix of currencies out there, it is something we're watching because it is an interesting development.
I'm glad you brought that up, Ben. Michael, I want to talk about your equity holdings later in the call, but before we get there, I just want to spend a moment on your own economic outlook. We've talked about various scenarios and what gold might do, for instance, in those scenarios. What is your take on the economy and the macro backdrop?
God, it's really hard to predict. I mean, the data that we see seems to go all over the place. Labor's softening, but maybe not as much as expected. Corporate profits have been a little stronger than expected, but outlooks have been more mixed. Certain industries have performed better than others. Like I said, the Fed, I think the market and the economy are helping the Fed do its job right now by allowing it to take its time and not having to act too quickly and maybe even having interest rates higher for longer. So it really is an interesting time. I think as long as you have people working and spending and corporate profits holding up, it's very hard to see a recession. On the other hand, some of those factors could be lagging indicators, labor being one of them. And if that were to turn in a material way, or consumers were to stop spending in a material way, I think that would enhance the risk of a recession sooner rather than later. But the way things are going at the moment, there's this sort of sweet spot where we're not lurching too much towards a recession. We're not seeing real aggressive economic growth, but we are seeing growth. And there is some debate about where that growth is coming from. Is it fiscal spending and government spending that's provided a lot of that growth, and what will happen if that spigot is turned off, how much of it's private sector growth, how much of it's due to the developments in AI and other technology related activities, our industrial companies starting to come back and increase their activities. So there's a lot happening. And what we're trying to do is just manage it rather than take big, broad, long-term macro bets. We're trying to manage what the market's giving us and tweak the portfolio along the way so that we're ready if things do change in a material way, one way or the other. And so I think there's a lot of unanswered questions, and we're all operating on that. We all think the Fed's cutting rates, I guess, but when? There is some precedent for higher interest rates for longer. If you go back to the 1980s, where while the bias was declining interest rates because of what happened earlier that decade, you had several strong years of economic growth in the 1980s with interest rates at levels where we're seeing them right now. And so there is precedent for economic growth to be pretty robust with interest rates where they are. And that allows the Fed to have credibility and also not have to move too aggressively. And my own view would be that the longer they can not have to cut rates, it makes cutting rates a more powerful tool in the long run if they have to use it later to offset an economic recession. So I think the market and the economic activity has helped the Fed to not have to move aggressively on the downside. And that's a benefit in terms of credibility and maybe future tools in the toolbox if they're needed. And as long as people are working and spending and corporate profits are holding up to put a floor under the stock market, the stock market's not cheap, but corporate profits are helping to provide a foundation for it. I don't see a recession happening, tomorrow, but there are some data, credit card spending, reduction in savings, in delinquencies on maybe auto loans and some credit card reserves. There have been, unemployment has ticked up a little bit. So these things are all something to keep watching, commercial real estate and the likely refinancings that are going to go on there in the next few years. These are all factors to keep in mind and watch, but they haven't been enough to offset the scenario that we have at the moment.
I think Jay Powell has a lot to watch, and so do we. So with that, I want to turn to Ben and ask a question. Wednesday is D-Day. That is Disney Day. It's the day of the shareholder vote at Disney. It pits the company's board candidates against those nominated. It's the company's nominees for the board against those nominated by activist investor Nelson Peltz. Peltz and Disney CEO Bob Iger have been at war for a while over the future of the company. But the state of affairs has been extremely beneficial for the stock, which is kind of ironic. How do you think the vote will go, Ben? And what do you make of the stock, which Barron's recommended in November?
Well, I just want to start off by saying I don't think the stock has gone up because you had this board battle going up. I think it's been going up because Bob Iger has made a lot of tough decisions, and they've been the right ones for the company. Barron's picked the stock back in July 28th, and it's gained 42% since then. It's outpaced the S&P 500's 15%. And we just looked at it as a valuation situation. It's like stock had gotten beaten up and these businesses all had issues to them. But if those issues could start being addressed, the stock would do much better. And that's what we're seeing now. I was looking at a B of A note this morning. They pointed out four things that are really driving the stock right now. They call the bullish drivers. One is strong free cash flow generation. They're going to exceed their, it looks like they're going to exceed their fiscal 24 guidance of $8 billion. The parks have continued momentum. That's something our Jack Howe has been writing about. The movies are supposed to be better, the ones that are coming out. They can't be much worse. And then you have more confidence that the streaming business is going to be able to turn profitable by the fourth quarter of 2024. And so you put that all together and you have a stock that has done well and can continue to do well, which brings us back to the board battle. To me, it's noise. you know, this is the kind of thing that gets a lot of attention, but I don't think it's going to move the needle one way or the other for the stock, as long as the business keeps doing well and Iger keeps making the right decisions. And so I look at it, and I'm like, okay, I shrug. You know, to me, it's, you know, it's the kind of thing that's made for television, but not necessarily made for the stock market.
Although it's been pretty good for the stock market. So let me ask you, though, one of Iger's biggest jobs, obviously, arguably his most important job, is finding a successor. And how is he doing in that department?
Yeah, that's so.
CEO.
Yeah, I mean, that's been Peltz's biggest complaint. I think he says that Iger can't be trusted to make this choice. And if you look at his last choice, that's probably true. Chapek didn't do a great job, or at least, you know, he took over at a very difficult time, put it that way, and Iger came back in. You do have four names that keep coming up. One is ESPN chairman Jimmy Pitaro. You have the Disney, they call them the Disney Experiences chairmen. They have the parks, Joseph Amaro, or Josh D'Amaro. And then you have the co-chairs of Disney Entertainment. That's Alan Bergman and Dana Walden. CNBC had a big story today about how Walden could be this dark horse candidate, maybe the first female CEO of Disney. But I think there's going to be a lot of attention paid to this, because Iger can't run Disney forever, and he needs to be able to bring in someone who can, you know, handle the management of all these different businesses that are competing right now. And it is a difficult time. You do have the, you know, cable is not generating the same revenues that it did before, and streaming needs to get profitable. And that's a tough position to be in. And so it's going to be a hard choice.
Well, if he doesn't find the right person, if the board doesn't find the right person, there are going to be calls to break up the company, but we're looking far down the road there.
So, yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, interesting situation. So Michael mentioned earnings and the importance of corporate earnings earlier in the call. We don't have any major companies reporting earnings this week, but I call it the quiet before the storm, because second quarter earnings season kicks off in a big way next week. We'll hear from Delta Airlines midweek. We'll hear from some of the biggest banks. So, Ben, what kind of quarter is Wall Street expecting? Is it going to be a good one for corporate earnings? What are the estimates out there?
Well, the estimates are for total earnings of $54.64. That's cumulative for the S&P 500. And it's a good number, not a great number. And really that's what we see when looking out over the entire year, is that, you know, the earnings are backloaded. So you're expecting $54.64 in the first quarter, but $242.47 for the entire year. Which would be double-digit growth. I think that's 10 or 11% over 2023. But a lot of it is coming in the third and fourth quarters. So, I mean, I think the biggest thing is you do need to see the beats. That'll make that back half number easier to hit. But throughout the whole year, you do need these earnings to at least stay where they are or move higher. Because I think with the market trading where it is, which is about 21 times 12-month forward earnings, that's a pretty high valuation, and you need to have the earnings come through for that to happen. I think it's doable. Much of the earnings growth last year was came from the big tech companies, and there's some expectation that you're going to start to see earnings come through for other companies, not just big tech. And so I think that's what we need to pay attention for to. And just go back to the Michael's comments about the economy being so important, because if you have the economy is continues to recover, or at least holds up pretty well, you could see these cyclical type companies have stronger earnings, and that'll help hit these numbers. And so it's something we're going to pay attention to throughout the whole year.
One thing I'm going to be paying attention to is the jobs numbers this week. We have the JOLTS numbers. That's the job openings. We've got the ADP employment report, and we've got the government's jobs numbers coming Friday. This is the numbers for March. So what's the running estimate for the payroll figure on Friday?
So it's supposed to be 192,500. That would be down from 275,000. The unemployment rate is supposed to tick down to 3.8% from 3.9%. You know, they're solid numbers. They're good numbers. And I think the market needs to see that. They don't want to be too strong, because then they're going to worry about the Fed and those rate cuts being pushed off, or perhaps even the Fed go into a more neutral bias instead of a cutting bias. The average hourly earnings is also going to be important to watch. the month over month number is supposed to go up by 0.3%. That'd be more than the previous month, 0.1%, though the year over year number is expected to drop to 4.1%. Versus 4.3%. But these are the numbers that are going to be very much in focus. And I look at some of the companies out there that that are exposed to the labor market. Like last week we had Cintas, which among a lot of other things does make uniforms for companies, and they had a very good quarter. Stock had a big jump last week, and I think that says that maybe there is still some strength within this employment market. So it's going to be, I think, the next big event to really move the market, especially because we don't have earnings, will be that payrolls number on Friday.
That's a good point. As Michael said, people are out there and working and spending, and this is expected to continue. We will be watching that number closely. So, Michael, I want to spend a few minutes on some of your equity holdings. You divide your equity position into two sleeves. One is growth equities, and the other is commodities, raw materials, real estate, more hard asset-oriented equities. So tell us a little bit about the growth equities you like, and then we'll look at some of the others.
Yeah, we try to, it's a fairly concentrated approach, and it's a multi-cap approach. Mm-hmm. I guess it would be a multi-cap core type strategy. And so we're looking for 30 to 50 really good long-term growth stories over a multi-year period. We're long-term investors. We're a low turnover philosophy versus a heavy trading philosophy. So we're looking for long-term stories that are going to play out. And growth is kind of an interesting name because we have an eclectic collection of stocks. When people have looked at our portfolio of equities, they look at some of the names and say, boy, that doesn't look like a growth fund. I mean, and then there's some other names that are growth stocks or growthier names. So in our portfolio, you can pair up an NVIDIA, for example, in the semiconductor space with, I'll mention Disney because Ben talked about it. We're an owner in both of our permanent portfolio and our aggressive growth portfolios. So we're actively involved in that story. And then in a variety of industries. And so we look for characteristics. We kind of do an approach of top-down, broader thinking, macro thinking. Where do we want to be in the next 3 to 5 years in terms of broader equity stories? Broader themes, et cetera. What's the macro and economic environment look like? And mix all that around. And then look for kind of some general trends and areas that we want to be. Then we flip that upside down and look at it from a more micro basis where we're looking at specific industries and sub-industries. And then sort of the best among the group in those areas that we might want to invest in. The first among equals, so to speak. And then we will look to get in at a reasonable valuation and hope the story plays out and monitor the story and watch the story. And that's how we invest. And so we're broadly diversified in the growth sector right now.
Can you give us some names to get a sense of how this strategy is put into play?
Yeah, I mean, so I mentioned NVIDIA in the semiconductor space. I mentioned Disney in the entertainment space. Mm-hmm. We own Meta. We own Illinois Tool Works, a heavy industrial name. We own FedEx, a transportation name. We in the financial area, we own, and this is an example, too, of broad sectors and subsectors. So in the financial services space, for example, we got, big investment bank, Morgan Stanley, paired off with a business like Charles Schwab, which is more of a retail based, broader Main Street story with retail investors. We then have one of the automated payment services, Affirm Holdings, in that fintech space. So we try to broaden our exposure in some of these areas among different sectors of a broader sector.
What about on the commodity side? What do you like?
On the commodity side, like I said, we divvy it up between traditional growths and we don't double dip. So we make a determination that a certain stock or sector or subsectors are going to be in the harder asset sleeve or the growth sleeve. And we sort of keep them in those lanes. So on the harder asset sleeve, it's energy, it's commodities, it's raw materials. It's the economic raw materials of production, right? So you've got various forms of energy. You have various commodities. You have real estate and real estate investment trusts in a variety of different, you know, subsectors. And so you could pair up in that portfolio something like a Freeport-McMoRan on the copper side with BHP Billiton, or a small natural gas play, Birchcliff Energy in Canada. And then on the real estate side, you know, pair off something like an Essex Properties on the residential side with Federal Realty on the Main Street retail side, with a Simon Properties on the mall side, and you know, Boston Properties on the office space. So it's those are examples of names we own, and it gives you some sense of the diversification that we have.
So we had a question from Alfred, who wants to know your outlook on the commercial real estate market. You just mentioned a bunch of commercial real estate REITs. Do you have a broader outlook on the market?
It's an area that I think is still very much in flux, because I think with respect to the office market, especially in the urban areas, you know, the main cities, you're still dealing with the after effects of work from home, work in the office, work-life balance, all of those sorts of things that are playing out. And different cities are experiencing different things so far in this post-COVID world. I know in San Francisco, our vacancy rates are still pretty high, and there's a lot of people working from home, not coming downtown that much. They're trying to change that, but it's been stubborn. And the various industries that operate out here, it's conducive to maybe working at home in a way that maybe it's not as conducive in other areas. But you've got that balance, and you have a lot of space that's unused. And so vacancy rates are up. You have owners that maybe took on debt with higher vacancy rates that are coming up for refinancings. And I literally not a day goes by where you're not reading about some sort of office property or urban property that is being brought back to the banks because they either can't refi or they don't have the capital to maintain the property. The lease rates are really low. And the prices, when you look at, you know, where the entity bought the price and where they're handing it off back to the bank and refinancing, you can see the wealth destruction in, at least on paper, in some of these properties, given the state of transition we are with how people are going to work and use urban areas in the future. So it's an area that's very much in flux. And the risk with that is that if you have a lot of these debt financings coming due, and you have a situation where the liquidity or the availability of credit may not be there, then that's going to create further problems that may leak into and affect the broader economy. So I think it's a risk area. So far, it has not been enough to overturn the economy in any way, but I think it remains a risk factor and will do so for the next couple of years.
Fair enough. Good explanation. So, Ben, we had a batch of questions about the outlook for oil and gas exploration and refining, and some questions about global oil demand. I thought you might be able to take those. What are you seeing? What's the outlook?
I think a lot depends on the price of oil. As always, when you see with a lot of these types of commodity centered stocks. And I do think oil is starting to look a little more interesting than it has. It is strengthening. We're seeing that show up in things like gas prices. We're at the highest point on, I think, WTI crude really since last November. That's good for oil stocks. I think if the economy is getting stronger, we saw the ISM manufacturing index finally turn positive. That's also going to be good for energy consumption and energy stocks. The one thing I will say is that energy stocks look like they're actually leading the price of oil right now, which to me is kind of interesting. You might want to be just a little bit careful. They have they look a little bit overbought at this moment, but I think oil stocks are, you know, if that oil price keeps rising, they're in a good position.
Sounds good. Interesting. So George asked a question, Michael, that I've wondered myself. Do you have thoughts on Bitcoin or creating a Bitcoin allocation in the fund?
Yeah, I'll hit on that a sec. Just a quick comment on energy because it's an area we're very involved in. I would mirror Ben's comments. We nibbled in a lot of the energy stocks a while back when they were a little bit cheaper, and they have run quite a bit here. And so for a long-term investor, they're great places to be. The world needs fossil fuels. The transition to green and alternative energy is going to take a long, long time. And if global demand picks up and growth occurs, you're going to have a situation where the price of oil could go significantly higher if you don't increase production. So for long-term, these companies typically pay great dividends. They do additional dividends when times are good. They do share buybacks. So for an investor that's looking for a great total return area, these are good stocks to take a look at. They have run a little bit. You might want to wait for a little bit of a pullback. But even here, most of them are trading at below market multiples and providing yields that are competitive with where interest rates are. So it's an interesting area. With respect to...
Before you go on to Bitcoin, can I ask you, do you have any favorite energy stocks?
We spread our bets among different areas of the energy space. So we own, you know, Chevron and Exxon on the big integrated space. We own Ovintiv on the development space, Devon Energy and Birchcliff in the natural gas space. So I mean, we're spread out in a number of areas. Texas Pacific Land Trust we own as a royalty play on oil and gas development in the United States. So you know, we're again subsetting and spreading our bets in a number of areas in these sectors, because sometimes different subsectors behave, you know, differently than the broader sector may imply. This is true of gold and gold mining stocks, actually, by the way, not to go back too far to the conversation, but gold miners don't always track what goes on in the price of gold.
And they've been lagging the price of gold.
They have. Yep. They have.
All right. Now on to Bitcoin.
So our take on Bitcoin, we don't use it and don't feel we need it to execute our strategy. We have enough hedges and alternative assets and non-correlative features in our portfolio so that we don't feel like we need to add it. And I would say that it's an evolving asset class. I mean, it's relatively new on the scene in the last 10, 15 years. And so we're all still learning about it. It most definitely is an asset class. But I think there are some attributes to it that maybe haven't been borne out or proven over time. And so investors need to be careful. It's very difficult to value. I'm not sure I've discovered a valuation metric for it other than what somebody else is going to pay for it at some point. And that seems to be all over the place, depending on how people feel about it. It's gotten a shot of legitimacy lately with the creation of ETFs, and that maybe was involved in a bump from where it was trading beforehand, but we still really don't even know that. It seems to correlate. There's been a lot made that it's an alternative asset like gold for portfolios. I would disagree with that. There's no evidence that demonstrates that. It is an asset class and it isn't stocks and bonds. So if you want to make that claim, okay, I can buy that. But it definitely has not behaved the way gold has behaved. And so to make the claim that it's a hedge like gold, I think is inaccurate at this time. That may prove to be true as we get more trading history, but I don't think, given the history we have at the moment, that that is really true. It hasn't been borne out by the data. What I would say, and this may not be the right discussion if you're looking at it as a hedge, but it seems to correlate very strongly with lower cost of capital and the movement of growth stocks. And so I think that bears watching as well in terms of how you use it. It's tough to insure. There's a little mystery as to how the asset is created, what the potential to create more of it is, what the scarcity value is on it. And so I think as a portfolio manager, as a fiduciary to our shareholders, I don't feel like I know enough about it to put it in our portfolios. I don't want to get up one morning and discover that, you know, X percent of my portfolio has disappeared through some theft or something. And this is probably a naive take on it. So I will allow for my naivete on this one, but I just don't feel like we know enough in our fund to utilize it properly. And we have enough hedges built in other ways and offsets to accomplish what we need to do without it. But it is a legitimate asset class. And when we're asked about it, tell people that, look, as long as you fully understand it, as long as you fully understand the risks and rewards, the taxation of it, et cetera, then good luck. We're not against it. We just feel like you got to go in with both eyes wide open in terms of what we know about it at this point.
I was going to end the call here, but we got a question that I think is a good one. There's been a lot of discussion lately about the rise in chocolate prices. Bad news for us chocolate lovers. And Shirley asks, can you identify any good cocoa producers?
I'm a chocolate guy myself.
that's the consumer, Michael.
but off the top of my head, no. But we've noticed that. And I think it's been true of a lot of commodities, whether the industrial sort or even the agriculture sort, and that's translated to higher prices at the consumer level. We hear a lot of talk about shrinkflation, and while the prices on the ground that consumers are paying for a lot of things don't necessarily equate with the declining inflation that's shown in the macro statistics, there is a little bit of a disconnect from our perception between what's going on the ground with people living their daily lives, whether it's the price of gas, whether it's the price of food, certain commodities that go into the food, clothing, you know, who knows what, and what the macro statistics say on a month-to-month basis. And I think that's one source of discomfort among investors and consumers, where the macro story is inflation's declining, it's stagnating around, you know, 3% or maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less, but somewhere around there. But yet, you know, the cost to go on vacation's gone up, to buy an airline ticket, to buy food. I used to get 16 ounces in my package. Now I'm only getting 13 or 14 because they're packaging it differently, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that that's a source of investors' unease with respect to, you know, what the data shows versus what's going on the ground as we live our lives. Not but I don't have a cocoa producer for you right now.
I was going to say, not quite the answer, Shirley, or I expected, but
I just
good observation. Go ahead, Ben.
And I just want to point out, we picked Hershey last week on expectations that cocoa would fall soon. Cocoa's hitting a new high today, which is disconcerting. But Hershey is up 2.2% despite that today, which I find very odd as well. So I'm going to have to do more thinking on that. But hopefully those cocoa prices start coming down soon.
All right. Well, go enjoy a piece of chocolate, everyone, despite the high price. And thank you for tuning in today. I want to thank you, Michael and Ben, for joining me on the call.
Thanks, Lauren. Thanks for having me anytime. And nice chatting with you, Ben.
Thanks.
A pleasure. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and thanks for your good questions. Please join us again next Monday. Ben and I will be discussing the big banks and other notable companies reporting second quarter earnings. There should be a lot to talk about. Thanks again, everyone. Stay well and have a good week.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.